Nobody had raked since then. Sloppy. A man and a woman were sitting in the top row arguing about somebody named Samantha. When they saw me, they stopped, annoyed, and got up. They moved the conversation back into the dance hall. The noise of the music in the crowd sounded tinny and far away, like it was echoing from the bottom of an oil tanker. I walked around the perimeter of the arena to a metal door with a sidebar and a white sign that read, "Employees Only." I looked for an alarm wire. None. No surveillance camera. I pushed the door open. Inside was an empty office with cheesy walnut paneling and pink carpeting. There were three metal desks. On the wall were framed posters of Tilden Sheckley's washed-up B-grade artists, Julie Kearns among them. There was plenty of blank space on the wall for Miranda Daniels a few years down the line, probably several others, too. Two doors led out of the room, left and right. The left one said Studio, and the right said Sheck. I looked for surveillance equipment on the Sheck door and found none. Okay. The handle turned. One look at the layout of the office and I was tempted to close the door and try coming back in again, just to make sure I was seeing correctly. It looked like a cross between a safari hunter's tent and a hard rock cafe. A huge zebra skin rug took up most of the floor. A mounted tiger's head glared at me from the wall behind the desk. The ceiling was decorated with deer antlers like stalactites. On the east wall, a padlocked gun display glowed from inside, showing off all sorts of rifles and shotguns. On the west wall, an identical case was filled with musical instruments, a fiddle, two acoustic guitars, a black electric. I looked closer at the instruments. The fiddle had Bob Wills' name on it, set in mother of pearl. I went to the desk. After 5 minutes rummaging, I hadn't learned much. The few personal records Sheckley kept were all done by hand, scrawled in a third-grade cursive, with all the B's and D's slanting backward and none of the I's dotted. He was a doodler, little stars and curly cues adorned the margins of his notes. Sheck had been making some phone calls recently about a trucking company he owned that had apparently been losing stock value. He also had notes on phone calls he'd made with Les, among other agents, discussing the terms of various deals with performers scheduled to play the paintbrush. As Lena the bartender had indicated, there were several notes about managers and agents protesting Tilden's unstated rights to his radio broadcasts of the headliner shows. Apparently, the artist got no percentage of the syndication money and had no say over the mix or content of the show that was recorded. There were also airline receipts for trips to Europe dating back several years, mostly to Germany and the Czech Republic. Some were made out to Tilden Sheckley, others to someone named Alexander Blankeagle. On two of the itineraries from early last year, Alexander Blankeagle was listed as traveling with Julie Kearns. I took those. Last was a folder with a schedule of artists' names, next to dates they had performed over the last 2 years. Some of these names had checks, some stars. There were no notes about Miranda Daniels, no pictures of Les St. Pierre with dart holes in his forehead. I walked back into the main office and tried the second door, the one labeled Studio. It opened easily. The room on the other side was about 20 by 20, brightly lit and completely quiet. The walls and ceiling were white acoustic tile, the floor tan industrial carpet. Clumps of boom microphone stands stuck up here and there like oversized toothpick sculptures. The left wall was covered with milk crates, towers of expensive stereo equipment and speakers all stacked together haphazardly, many topped with collections of old McDonald's soda cups. Against the right wall was a 10-foot-long mixing board. A man sat sideways next to it in a battered easy chair, turning control knobs and listening through Walkman-style earphones. He was oddly built, muscular but gangly, his face angular and goofy-looking with freckles in a raccoon pattern across his nose and ears that, if not pinned back by headphones, would have made perfect little radar dishes on the sides of his head. A standard issue, hayseed. The only thing not comical about him was the bulge under his beige windbreaker, right about where a shoulder holster would go. He was most definitely drunk. A near-empty bottle of Captain Morgan's sat next to him on the console. His eyes were heavy-lidded and his fingers were having trouble with the soundboard controls. I stepped into the room. When Hayseed finally noticed me, he took a few seconds of blinking and frowning to decide if I wasn't just another stack of musical equipment. He brought the easy chair into upright position and spent some time trying to connect both his feet to the floor. He got his hands working, groped up the side of his head until he found the earphones and removed them. "Evening," I said. He looked at me more closely, and his ears turned red.
"God damn, Jean."
He said Jean the French way, the Claude Van Damme way. I was about to correct him when he stood up and began staggering toward me, reaching for the now exposed black butt of his gun with one unsteady hand. That pretty much decided me against the diplomatic approach. Chapter 11. I met Hayseed halfway across the room and heel-kicked him in the shin to take his mind off the gun. He grunted, stumbled forward one more step, his hands moving down instinctively toward the pain. I grabbed his shoulders and forced him backward. When he tipped over the side of the easy chair, his knees went up and his butt sank, and the back of his head hit the mixing board. The equalizer lights did a crazy little surge. His bottle of Captain Morgan's toppled over, speckling the controls with rum. Hayseed stayed put, his arms splayed and his knees up around his ears in hogtie position. He made a little groaning sound in his throat like he was showing displeasure at a very bad pun. I extracted a .38 revolver from his shoulder holster, emptied its chambers, threw gun and bullets into a nearby milk crate. I found his wallet in the pocket of his windbreaker and emptied that too. He had $12, a driver's license that read Alexander Blanc Eagle, 1600 Mecca, Hollywood Park, Texas, and a Paintbrush Enterprises business card identifying him as business manager. I looked at the mixing board. Rows of equalizer lights still bounced up and down happily. A bank of CD burners and digital disc drives were daisy-chained together, all with beady little green eyes ready to go. There were 6 or 7 chunky 1 gigabyte cartridges scattered across the board. I picked up the earphones Alex had been wearing and listened. Country music, recorded live, male singer, nothing I recognized. Behind the chair was an unzipped black duffel bag filled with more recording cartridges and some microphone cords and a bunch of paper folders and files I didn't have time to look through. Blanc Eagle's groaning changed pitch, got a little more insistent. I helped him untangle his legs from his ears, then got him seated the right way again. His clothes fit him like a short-sheeted bed, and his once nicely combed hair was doing a little swirly unicorn thing on top of his head. He massaged his shin.
"I need a damn drink."
"No, you damn don't." He tried to sit up, then decided that didn't feel too good and settled back in. He tried to make some thick, fuzzy calculations in his head.
"You ain't John."
"No," I agreed, "I'm not."
"But, Shaq..."
He knit his eyebrows together, trying to think.
"You look a little..."
"Like Jean," I supplied.
"So it would seem."
Alexander Blanc Eagle rubbed his jaw, pulled his lower lip. There was a little ewe of blood on the gum line under one of his teeth.
"What do you want?"
"Not to get mistaken for Jean and killed, preferably." He frowned. He didn't understand. Our little dance across the room might have happened 100 years ago, to somebody else. "I'm here about a friend of yours," I said. "Julie Kearns." The name registered slowly, sinking in through layers of rum haze until it went off like a depth charge somewhere far under the surface. Blanc Eagle's freckles darkened into a solid red-brown band across his nose.
"Julie," he repeated.
"She was murdered." His eyebrows went up, his mouth softened. His eyes cast farther afield for something to latch on to. Nostalgia mode. I had maybe 5 minutes when he might be open to questions. Not that drunks have predictable emotional cycles, but they do follow a brand of chaos theory that makes sense once you've been around enough of them, or been made an alumni yourself. I overturned a milk crate, shook the electrical cords out of it, and sat down next to Blanc Eagle. I unfolded one of the airline receipts I'd taken from Sheckley's desk and handed it across. You and Julie went to Europe together a couple of times on Sheckley's tab. Were you close? Blanc Eagle stared at the receipt. His focus dissipated again. His eyes watered up.
Oh, man.
He curled forward and put the hand with the airline receipt against his forehead. The great Karnak reading a card. He scrunched his eyes together and swallowed and started shuddering. Now, I'll admit to a certain manly discomfort when another guy starts to cry in front of me, even if he is drunk and funny-looking and recently guilty of trying to draw a gun on me. I sat very still until Blanc Eagle got his body under control. One muddy waters, two muddy waters. 27 muddy waters later, he sat up, wiped his nose with his knuckles. He set the airline receipt on the arm of the chair and patted it.
I got to go. I got to...
He looked at the soundboard, struggling to remember what he'd been doing. He started gathering up the 1 gigabyte cartridges, sticking them in his windbreaker pockets that were a little too small to hold them. I handed him one that kept slipping away. You're copying a lot of music here. He stuffed the last of the discs in his pocket, then made a feeble attempt to clean the drops of Captain Morgan's spiced rum off the soundboard's controls, wiping between the lines of knobs with his fingers.
Shag is crazy. I can't just... I'm in 6 years deep now. He can't expect...
Alex patted his shoulder holster, realized it was empty. Over there, I pointed. Sheckley can't expect what? Blanc Eagle glanced over at his unloaded gun in the milk crate, then at me, suspicious how I'd pulled that off.
What was your name?
He asked. I told him. He repeated,
Navarre,
3 times, trying to place it.
You know Julie?
I was tailing her the day she got murdered. Maybe I helped it happen by applying pressure on her at the wrong time. I don't feel particularly good about that. Alex Blanc Eagle pulled together enough anger to sound almost sober.
You're another goddamn investigator.
Another? He tried to maintain the glare, but he didn't have the attention span or the energy or the sobriety for it. His eyes zigzagged down and came to rest on my navel. He muttered unconvincingly,
Get out of here.
Alex, you've had some kind of disagreement with Sheck. You're clearing out your stuff. It's got to be in connection with the other things that have been happening. Maybe you should talk to me.
Things'll work out. You don't worry about Sheck, you understand? Les St. Pierre couldn't do it. I'll take care of it myself.
Take care of what, exactly? Blanc Eagle looked down at his half-packed duffel bag and wavered between anger and wistfulness. Maybe if I'd had more time and more Captain Morgans, I could have eventually plied him into a temporary friendship. But just then the door of the studio opened, and my stunt double came in. Jean did look enough like me that I couldn't label Alex a complete idiot for making the mistake. Jean was much thicker in every part of his body, though, slightly taller, his black hair curlier. He was also less comfortably and more expensively dressed, black boots, tight gray slacks, a black turtleneck, a gray linen jacket. It must have been 1,000 degrees in those clothes. His left hand casually held a gray and black Beretta that matched his outfit perfectly. His eyes were the same color as mine, hazel, but they were smaller and amorally fierce as a crab's. Put me on the GNC high-cal, high-fiber diet and forced me to dress that way, and I probably would have looked the same. Jean looked around calmly. He zeroed in on the shoulder holster under Alex Blanc Eagle's windbreaker, dismissed it, then noticed Blanc Eagle's full pockets in the duffel bag. Finally, he looked at me. That took a little longer. Eyes still on me, Jean asked Alex a calm 3-word question in German. Blanc Eagle responded in the same language, a negative answer. Jean held out his hand. Alex struggled to his feet. He limped over to us, trying to keep the weight off his recently kicked shin. He started fumbling with his pockets, pulling out the recording cartridges one by one and handing them to Jean. Two of the discs clattered to the floor. When Alex bent over to get them, Jean kicked him in the ribs just hard enough to send Blanc Eagle sprawling. Jean did it without anger or change of expression, the way a kid might push over a roly-poly bug. Alex stayed on the carpet, blinking, reorienting himself, then began the process of getting his limbs to work. Jean's next question, still in German, was aimed at me. I shrugged helplessly. Jean looked at Alex, who was now up on one elbow and seemed quite content to stay that way. Blanc Eagle squinted up at me for a long time. He said slowly and deliberately,
"He's a steel player, for God's sake. I forgot to reschedule the fucking bass track session tonight, is all."
Jean scrutinized me one more time, trying to burn a hole in my face with those little crab eyes. I tried to look like an ignorant steel guitar player. I managed the ignorant part pretty well. Finally, Jean nodded at the door.
"Get out, then."
His English was perfect, the accent British. A German speaker with a French name and a British accent. It made about as much sense as anything else I'd come across so far. I looked down at Alex Blanc Eagle.
"Don't worry about those bass tracks," Alex told me. "I'll take care of it."
There was absolutely no confidence in his voice. As I left, Jean and Alex were having a very quiet, very reasonable conversation in German. Jean did most of the talking, slapping the gray and black Beretta against his thigh with a casual carelessness that reminded me very much of his boss, Tilden Sheckley. When I got back to the main room, I could have stuck around longer. Tammy Vaughn was just starting her first number, "Daddy Taught Me Dancin'." I wasn't a country fan, but I'd heard it once or twice on the radio, and Tammy sounded fine. The 200 or so folks on the dance floor looked like a paltry crowd in the vastness of the hall, but they were hooting and hollering their best. Tilden Sheckley was standing by the soundboard, still having a lively argument with a woman in the sky-blue jumpsuit. I could have asked a lot of questions, done some two-stepping with big-haired women, maybe met a few more nice men with guns. Instead, I said goodbye to Lena the bartender. She was busy now, a bottle of tequila in either hand, but she told me to stick around for a while longer. Her break was coming up soon. I told her thanks anyway. I'd had enough of the Indian paintbrush for one night. Chapter 12. When I woke up on Tuesday, I stared at the ceiling for a long time. I felt queasy, disoriented, like I'd been looking through someone else's prescription lenses too long. I groped along the windowsill until I found the business card from Julie Kern's wallet. The words on it hadn't changed. Les St. Pierre Talent, Milo Chavez Associate. Milo's wad of 50s was still there, too, not much lighter for my night on the town. Finally, I got up, did the Chen Long form in the backyard, then showered and made migas for myself and Robert Johnson. I checked the latest Austin Chronicle. Miranda Daniels was scheduled to start at the Cactus Cafe at 8 p.m., After doing the dishes, I called my brother Garrett and left a message telling him, "Surprise, we had plans tonight." I love my brother. I love having a free place to sleep in Austin even more. I tried Detective Schaefer at SAPD Homicide. Schaefer wasn't in. Milo Chavez wasn't in either. I peeled off a stack of Milo's 50s, enough for my October rent, and left it in an envelope on the counter. Gary Hales would find it. Maybe, if things went well between now and next Friday, I'd be able to spring for November, too. But not yet. I left extra water and Friskies on the kitchen counter and a piece of newspaper where Robert Johnson would inevitably throw up when he realized I was gone overnight. Then I headed out for the VW. I hit Austin just after noon and spent a few more fruitless hours visiting Les St. Pierre's hangouts, talking to people who hadn't seen him recently. This time, I claimed to be a songwriter trying to get my tape to Les. I told everybody I had a great new surefire hit called Lovers from Lubbock. I found it difficult to generate much excitement. After a late lunch, I swung by Waterloo Records on North Lamar and found a Julie Kearns cassette from 1979 in the bargain bin. I bought it. There were no recordings by Miranda Daniels yet. There were quite a few CDs in the Texas Artists section on Sheckley's Split Rail label, such household names as Clay Bamberg and the Sagebrush Boys, Jeff Whitney, the Perdonalis Polka Men. I didn't buy them. I drove north on Lamar, right on 38th, into Hyde Park, following the route I'd taken last week on surveillance. I turned left on Speedway and parked across the street from Julie Kearns's house. The Hyde Park neighborhood is not quite as snooty as the name implies. It's equal parts college kid, aging hippie, and aging yuppie. It's got its share of bad elements, sleazy laundromats, dilapidated student housing, Baptist churches. The streets are quiet, shaded by live oaks and lined with quaintly run-down 1940s starter homes. Julie Kearns' place was just run-down, not quaint. Back in the 60s, it had probably been what my brother Garrett called a hobbit house. Above the door, a round stained-glass peace sign window was now grimy and broken. And the comets and suns that had once been painted along the trim of the roof and windows had been thinly whitewashed over. The yellow front lawn was shaded by a pecan tree so infested with webworms it looked like a cotton candy stick. About the only thing that looked well tended was Julie's planter box underneath the living room window, full of purple and yellow pansies. Even those were starting to wilt. Afternoon traffic on Speedway was heavy. An orange UT shuttle went by. Ford trucks with lawnmowers and rakes and whole Latino families in the back cruised for unkempt front yards. A good number of 70s Hondas and VW Bugs puttered down the street with peeling bumper stickers like Unreganable and Honor the Goddess. Austin, the only city in Texas where my car is inconspicuous. Nobody paid me any attention. Nobody stopped at the Kearns residence. If the police had been here, they hadn't left any obvious sign. I was about to cross the street and let myself in when a guy stuck his head in my passenger side window and said, "I thought that was you." Julie's across-the-street neighbor had horse-like features. He smiled, and you expected him to bray or nuzzle you for a sugar cube. His salt-and-pepper hair was clipped close around the ears, gelled, spiky on top. He wore a blue button-down shirt tucked into khaki walking shorts, tied with a multicolored Guatemalan belt. And when he leaned into the car, I didn't so much smell him as experience one of those surrealistic 15-second designer cologne ads. He grinned. "I knew you'd be back. I was sitting on my love seat having an espresso, and I thought, I bet that police detective will be back today. Then I looked out the window, and here you are." "Here I am," I agreed. "Listen, was it Jose?"
"Harris. Jose Harris."
He started to spell it.
"That's great, Mr. Harris, but..."
Jose held up one finger, like he just remembered something vitally important, and leaned farther into my car.
"Didn't I tell you?" he said, lowering his voice. "I told you something funny was going on."
"Yeah," I admitted. "You called it." I wondered what the hell he was talking about. Maybe Julie's murder had made the Austin American statesman, or maybe Jose was just percolating some of the great theories he'd offered me Saturday morning. How Miss Kearns needed his help because the Mafia was after her, or the Feds, or the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. Jose narrowed his eyes conspiratorially.
"I started thinking about it after I talked to you. I said to myself, why would the police be so interested in her? Why are they staking out her house? She's got one of those drug dealer boyfriends, doesn't she? She'll have to go into the witness protection program."
I told Jose he had a hell of a deductive mind.
Poor dears, but super agitated, he confided. She stopped making those sugar cookies for me, stopped saying hello. She's been looking like, well...
He waved his hand like I could easily imagine the crimes against fashion the poor dear had been perpetrating. I nodded, sympathetically.
She had that visitor, Saturday night?
I know, I assured him. We were watching the house. The visitor had been one of Julie's girlfriends, an amateur aromatherapist named Vina, whose innocuous life story I'd already delved into. Vina had come over to Julie's with her essential oil kit around 8 and left around 9. I didn't want to tell Jose that the chances of Vina being a mafia hitman were pretty slim. Jose leaned farther into my car. Another inch, and he'd be in my lap.
Are you going to break in? He asked. Check for traps?
I assured him that it was standard procedure, nothing to get alarmed about.
Oh, he nodded vigorously. I'll let you get to work. Aren't you supposed to give me your card in case I remember something later?
Give me your hand, I told him. He looked uncertain, then thrust it at me. I took my permanent black marker off the dashboard and inscribed Jose's palm with Irania's alternate voicemail number, the one that says, You have reached the Criminal Investigations Division. He frowned at it for a minute. Budget cutbacks, I explained. When I got to Julie's front door, it took me about 2 minutes to find the right dupe for the deadbolt. I leaned leisurely against the door frame, trying different keys and whistling while I worked. I smiled at an elderly couple walking by. Nobody yelled at me. Nobody set off any alarms. A licensed PI will tell you that committing crimes in the line of work is a myth. PIs gather evidence that might be used in court, and any evidence gathered illegally automatically ruins the case. So PIs are good boys and girls. They do surveillance from public property. They keep their noses clean. It's 90% true. The other 10% of the time, you need to find out something or retrieve something that's never going to see its way into court, and the client, usually a lawyer, doesn't care how illegally you do it, as long as you don't get caught and traced back to them. They'd just assume you're somebody unprincipled and unlicensed who can play a discreet game of hardball. That's how I'd worked for 5 years in San Francisco, unprincipled and unlicensed. Then I'd moved back to Texas, where my dad's old friends on the force had put increasing pressure on me to get licensed and work right. None of them wanted the embarrassment of busting Jack Navarre's kid. I jimmied the side bolt. Then I took the 2 days' worth of mail from Julie's box and went inside. The kitchen smelled like lemon and ammonia. The hardwood floors had been swept. Copies of Fiddle Player and Nashville Today were neatly stacked on the glass-topped fruit crate that served as a coffee table. There were fresh-cut flowers on the dining table. She'd left an orderly home for someone who was never coming back to it. I sat on the sofa and went through the mail. Bills. A letter from Tom and Sally Kearns in Oregon, and a pics of their new baby girl. The note said, Can't wait for you to see Andrea. Love, T&S. I stared at the pink, wrinkly face. Then I placed the photo and letter upside down on the coffee table. I did a quick sweep of the back rooms. No messages on the answering machine. Nothing to look at in the garbage can except molding coffee grounds. The only thing interesting was on the top shelf of Julie's bedroom closet. Buried under a down comforter was a two-tone brown suitcase, like you'd see in a vaudeville act. Inside, on top, were photos of Les St. Pierre. There was Les drinking beer with Merle Haggard, Les accepting an award from Tanya Tucker. Young Les in a wide-collared pink shirt, big curly hairdo, lots of polyester. Standing next to a similarly dressed disco cowboy who was probably famous once, but whom I didn't recognize. Underneath the photos were lots of men's clothes, packed more like someone had been emptying drawers than picking things for a trip. It was all socks and jockey shorts. Or maybe that's what Les St. Pierre wore when he traveled. Maybe I'd been going to the wrong vacation spots. I put the suitcase back. In the den, a green, hungry-looking parrot was sitting on its polished, madroned branch. He told me I was a noisy bastard, and then went back to scratching ravenously at his cuttlebone. I found some pistachios for him in the kitchen. Then I sat down at Julie's IBM PS2 and stared at a dark screen.
"Dickhead,"
the parrot croaked. He cracked a pistachio. "Pleased to meet you," I said. The corkboard behind the computer was cluttered with paper. There was a dog-eared picture of Julie Kearns as a young fiddle player, her auburn hair longer, her body slimmer. She was standing next to George Jones. There was a more recent picture of the Miranda Daniels Band with Julie in the forefront. The photo was surrounded by concert reviews clipped from local papers. A few sentences about Julie Kearns' fiddle playing, highlighted in pink. One front-page feature from the Statesman Entertainment section showed just Miranda Daniels, standing between a stand-up bass and a wagon wheel with a fake sunset backdrop behind her. The title boldly announced, "The Rebirth of Western Swing: Why a New Breed of Texas Talent Will Take Nashville by Storm." A smaller cork board to the left was more down-to-earth. It displayed $250 check stubs from Paintbrush Enterprises, also Julie's schedule and hourly pay scale for several jobs she'd taken through Cellus Temps in the last few months to make ends meet. Basic word processing and data entry for an assortment of big corporations in town. Whether or not Miranda Daniels was going to take Nashville by storm, it didn't look like Julie Kearns had been in any immediate danger of becoming affluent. I looked through Julie's floppy disks. I opened the horizontal cabinet and took out a thin stack of mildewed blue folders. I was just starting to look through one labeled personal when the front door opened and a man's voice said, "Anybody home?" Jose tiptoed into the study, smiling apologetically, like he needed to pee real bad. He looked around at the decor and said, "I had to see. You're lucky I didn't shoot you."
"Oh."
He started to laugh. Then he saw my face.
"You don't really have a gun, do you?"
I shrugged and turned back to the files. I never carry, but I didn't have to tell him that. Jose unfroze and began looking around the room, picking up knickknacks and checking titles on the bookshelf. The parrot cracked pistachios and watched him.
"Dickhead,"
the parrot said. I gave the bird some more nuts. I believe in positive reinforcement. On a quick look, Julie's personal file seemed to deal mostly with her debts. There were plenty of them. There was also some paperwork from statewide credit counseling that suggested Julie had entered into debt negotiation about 2 months ago. The house, the parrot, the 68 Cougar she was murdered in seemed to be her only assets. It looked like she had two mortgages on the house and was about one of Sheckley's paychecks away from becoming homeless. I started Julie's IBM, figuring I'd do a quick check, take the hard disk with me and look at it more leisurely later on if anything seemed of worth. There was nothing of worth. In fact, there was nothing at all. I sat there and stared at an empty green screen. I thought for a second, then turned off the machine and pried off the casing. The hard drive was still in its slot, erased but not removed. That was good. I wrestled it out, wrapped it in newspaper, and stuck it in my backpack. A project for Brother Garrett.
"What is it?"
Jose asked. He came up behind me now and was peering over my shoulder, fascinated by the open computer. The cologne was intense. The parrot sneezed. "Nothing," I said. "A lot of it. Somebody has tried to make sure there's nothing to be found on Julie Kern's computer." Jose said,
"It must have been the man who came over."
I stared at him. "What man?" Jose looked exasperated.
"That's what I was talking about outside. The man who came over Saturday night. You said you knew about him."
"Wait a minute." I did a mental checklist. Saturday night, the night before I'd confronted Julie myself, there hadn't been any man. I'd pulled standard surveillance, methods even Irania couldn't have found fault with. I'd watched the house until 11:05, which had been lights out plus 30 minutes. At that point, you can figure the subject is down for the count. I'd chalked Julie's tires on the off chance she'd go somewhere during the night. Then I'd driven home for a few hours' sleep before heading back to Austin at 4:30 the next morning. "When did this guy come over?" I demanded. Jose looked proud. "He banged on Julie's door at 11:15. I remembered to check my clock." The parrot ruffled his feathers and squawked, "Shit, shit, shit." "Yeah," I agreed. Chapter 13. When it came to snooping, Jose was a pro. He remembered that the visitor had woken up Julie Kearns at exactly 11:15 on Saturday night. He remembered the man going inside and arguing with Julie in her living room for 8 minutes 20 seconds. Jose had seen them through the window. He could describe the guy well. Latino, stocky, well-dressed in his late 50s, around 5'8", maybe 230 pounds. His car had been a BMW goldish color. Jose gave me the license, though after hearing the description of the visitor, I was pretty sure I didn't need it. Jose apologized that he'd only heard a few lines of their argument when the visitor came storming out of Julie's house. Something about money. Jose said Julie Kearns had been holding her .22 Ladysmith when she came onto the porch the second time, like she was chasing the guy out. "She didn't fire it." He sounded disappointed. I told Jose he'd done a great service for his country and hustled him out the door. He vowed to call the number on his hand if he remembered anything else. I went back inside Julie's house and stared at the disassembled computer. I looked at Dickhead the parrot, who just finished his last pistachio and was now eyeing my nose. Hungry, thirsty, alone. "Robert Johnson wouldn't like you," I told him. The parrot turned his head upside down and tried to look pathetic. "Great," I said, and held out my arm. Dickhead flew over and landed on my shoulder.
"Noisy bastard," he said in my ear.
"Sucker," I corrected. When I got to Guadalupe Avenue, otherwise known as the Drag, the sidewalks and crosswalks were clogged with students just getting out of their afternoon classes. The five-block stretch of shops and cafes bordering the west side of campus boasted an impressive selection of human flotsam, graying hippies, homeless people and street merchants, musicians and soapbox preachers, sorority girls. Across the street from the chaos, the big peaceful live oaks and white limestone buildings and red-tiled roofs of UT stretched out forever, like Rome or Oklahoma City, some place that had absolutely no concept of limited space. The Drag probably wasn't the best place in Austin to get some serious thinking done. On the other hand, nobody was going to bother me sitting on the sidewalk outside the student co-op with a parrot on my shoulder. Maybe Dickhead would volunteer a few choice expressions for the passers-by. Maybe if I put out a hat, somebody would drop coins in it. Meanwhile, I could watch time pass on the UT Tower clock and think about my favorite dead woman. Julie Kearns' finances didn't look good. Reading through them a little closer, I could see how much pressure she'd been under. She'd been getting harassing reminders from the bank that held her mortgages, from all the major credit card companies, from a local musician's credit union. The debt negotiations she started might have helped eventually, but not if she lost her biweekly paychecks from Sheck because she'd been getting too close to St. Pierre. Not if she lost her only paying gig with Miranda because of the Century Records deal. The temp jobs she'd been doing to fill in the cracks wouldn't have been enough to sustain her and pay the debts. So maybe she'd decided to do some dirty work. Maybe she'd found herself getting crushed to death between Les St. Pierre and Tilden Sheckley and had to play both ends against the middle. Steal a demo tape for Sheckley or go bankrupt. Find some dirt on Sheckley for Les St. Pierre or lose your gigs. She'd known Sheckley for years, worked in his office for most of that time, took trips to Europe with his business manager. She'd been in a position to find dirt. Maybe what she'd dug up had been a little too good. Les had disappeared before he could play his hand. Julie had gotten nervous. She'd been pressured by some unwanted visitors over the weekend, including me. Then finally she decided to set up some kind of emergency meeting Monday morning with someone she needed help from but didn't trust. She'd taken her .22, driven to San Antonio, and walked into her own murder. People get desperate, play in a league over their head, and often get killed. Certainly not the fault of the dashing investigator who'd only come in at the end of Act 5. Maybe. The scenario didn't comfort me any. It also didn't explain the suitcase full of Les St. Pierre's intimate apparel sitting in Julie's closet 2 weeks after he disappeared. Or the man in the gold BMW who knew enough about surveillance to spot me and outwait me at Julie Kern's on Saturday night. On the street, three guys in studded leather coats and green porcupine hairdos walked by smoking clove cigarettes. A group of girls in matching wrinkled flannel with long tangled hair and bleached white skin stopped for a minute to ask me if I knew a guy named Eagle. Flannel in Texas requires a real commitment. Until the cold fronts start coming in, anything except shorts and flip-flops requires real commitment. I told them I was impressed. Dickhead even whistled. The girls just rolled their eyes and kept walking. By 7 o'clock, the sky was turning purple. The grackles started coming in from the south again, and a curve of black clouds slid in from the north, smelling like rain. The last wave of college kids fluttered across Guadalupe, dispersing to see coffee shops or frat parties. I checked my brain for new revelations about Les St. Pierre and Julie Kearns, found I had none, then got up and dusted the street grime off my jeans. I went back to my VW and locked Dickhead inside with some pistachios and a cup of water. I walked across Guadalupe Avenue to the payphone. When I called my own machine, the Chico Marx voice said, "Oh, brother, you got a plenty messages." Caroline Smith had called, canceling our weekend plans because she had an out-of-town special assignment. She didn't sound particularly shaken up about it. Professor Mitchell had called from UTSA, asking me to bring a curriculum vitae and a dossier when I came to my interview on Saturday. Irania had called, reminding me she needed to hear by next week whether I was coming back to work, and by the way, could I take Jem for a few hours tomorrow night? It would mean a lot to him. I could hear Jem in the background singing the Barney the Dinosaur song at the top of his lungs. My next call was collect, person to person, to Gene Schaefer at the SAPD homicide office. Person to person was the most expensive calling rate I could think of. As usual, Schaefer accepted the charges graciously.
"What a privilege," he said. "I get to pay money to talk to you."
"We should form a calling circle.
You, me, Ralph Arguello?"
"Screw yourself, Navarre."
Ralph Arguello is one of my less reputable friends. I made the mistake of introducing Arguello to Schaefer once, thinking they could help each other on a West Side murder case. The problem started when Ralph offered Schaefer a finder's fee for any unclaimed goods the detective could send to Ralph's pawn shops from the SAPD evidence locker. Schaefer and Ralph did not come away from the encounter with a warm, fuzzy feeling.
"I assume you have an excellent reason for calling," Schaefer said.
"Julie Kearns." The walk light on Guadalupe changed. Students drifted across, their faces now featureless in the dusk.
"Schaefer?"
"I remember. The fiddler. I assumed you'd had enough sense to get off that case."
"Just curious what you'd found."
He hesitated, probably wondering if hanging up would be enough to dissuade me. Apparently he decided not.
"We found nothing. The job was clean and professional, only a few custodians in the SAC building that time of morning, and nobody saw anything. Weapon was a high-powered rifle, hasn't been found yet, and I doubt it will be. Your client's going to have to look elsewhere for missing demo tape."
"It's a little more than that now." I told Schaefer about Les St. Pierre's disappearance. I told him about Miranda Daniels' problems, getting out from under Tilden Sheckley's thumb, and Milo's theory that Les might have used information from Kearns in some kind of botched blackmail attempt. I told him about the man who had been arguing with Julie Kearns Saturday night. Quiet on the other end of the line. Too much of it.
"I figured you'd want to know about St. Pierre," I said. "I figured you'd want to find him. Clear up some of those pesky questions like,
Is he still alive? Did he get Kearns killed?
Sure, kid, thanks.
The guy in the BMW. Who does that sound like to you?
What do you mean?
Don't let's obfuscate, Schaefer. You know damn well it's Samuel Barrera. He was at Urania's not 2 hours after Kearns got gunned down. Alex Blonkeagle at the paintbrush hinted that another investigator besides me had been poking around.
Barrera's in this somehow. Not one of his 20 operatives, but Barrera himself.
When was the last time Sam had a contract so juicy he handled it personally?
I think you're jumping to some large conclusions. But you'll talk to Sam?
Schaefer hesitated.
As I remember, Barrera turned you down for a job a couple of years ago when you were shopping around.
What's that got to do with it?
What was it he told you? You weren't stable enough?
Disciplined. The word was disciplined.
Really stuck in your craw, didn't it?
I got a trainer. I stayed with the program.
Yeah, to prove what to who? All I'm saying, kid, you'd be ill-advised to go forward on this Sheckley case to see it as some personal competition between you and Barrera. I'm advising you, as a friend, to drop it. I know for a fact that Rainier isn't going to cover your butt.
I stared up at the phone lines above me. I counted rows of grackles. I said, you called it the Sheckley case. Why?
Call it whatever you want.
He's already talked to you, hasn't he? Barrera did, or some of his friends in the Bureau. What the hell is going on, Schaefer?
Now you're sounding paranoid. You think I can get pressured off a case that easy?
I thought about his choice of words.
Not easy at all. That's what scares me. Let it go, Trace.
I watched the lines of grackles. Every few seconds another little rag of darkness would flit in from the evening sky and join the congregation. You couldn't identify the screeching as coming from individual birds or even from the group of birds. The sonar static was disembodied, floating noise. It echoed up and down the malls between the limestone campus buildings behind me.
I'll think about what you said, I promised. If you insist on continuing, if there's anything else you need to tell me, anything that needs reporting, you'll be the first to know.
Schaefer paused. Then he laughed dryly, wearily, like a man who had lost so many coins in the same slot machine that the whole idea of bad luck was starting to be amusing.
I'm brimming with confidence about that, Navarre. I truly am.
Chapter 14. Wednesday night during midterms, to hear a country band. I hadn't figured the Cactus Cafe would exactly be standing room only. I was wrong. A small white board sign out front said, Miranda Daniels, cover $5. There was a line of about 50 people waiting to pay it. Most of them were couples in their mid-20s, clean-looking young urban kickers with nice haircuts and pressed denim and Tony Lama boots. A few college kids, a few older couples who looked like they'd just driven in from the ranch in Williamson County and were still trying to adjust to being around people instead of cows. At the back of the line, two guys were having an argument. One of them was my brother Garrett. Garrett's hard to miss with a wheelchair. It's a custom-made job, white and black Holstein hide-covered seat, dingo balls along the edges, bright red wheel grips set close to the axle like Garrett likes them. Nothing motorized. A Persian seat cushion designed for a guy whose weight distribution is different because he has no legs. He's plastered the back of the chair with bumper stickers. Save Barton Springs. I'd rather be growing hemp. Several advertising Nike and Converse. Garrett enjoys endorsing athletic shoes. The chair's got a beer cooler under the seat and a pouch for Garrett's one-hitter and a bicycle flag on a pole that Garrett long ago changed to a Jolly Roger. Garrett kids about putting retractable spikes on his wheels like they hadn't been her. At least, I think he's kidding. The guy he was arguing with had patched jeans and a black T-shirt and longish straw-colored hair. If I'd still been in California, I'd have pegged him for a surfer. He had the build and the windburned face and the jerky random head movements of somebody who'd been watching the crests of waves too long. He was blowing cigarette smoke at the floor and shaking his head.
No, no, no! Come on, man, Garrett protested. She's not Jimmy Buffett, okay? I just like the tunes. Hey, little bro, I want you to meet Cam Compton, the guitar player.
The guitar player looked up, annoyed that he had to be introduced at all. One of his brown irises had a bloody ring around it, as if somebody had tried to smash it in. He studied me for about 5 seconds before deciding I wasn't worth the trouble.
You and your brother got your brains in the same place, son?
His accent was pure Southern, too rounded in the vowels for Texas.
What you think? She's gonna get eaten alive, ain't she?
Sure, I said. Who are we talking about?
Son, son, son.
Compton jerked his head toward the cafe door. He flicked ashes at the carpet.
Miranda fucking Daniels, you idiot.
Hey, Cam, Garrett said. Calm it down, like I told you.
Calm it down, Compton repeated.
He took a long drag on a cigarette, gave me a smile that was not at all friendly.
Ain't I calm? Just need to teach a bitch a lesson is all.
Several young urban kickers in line glanced back nervously. Compton tugged on his T-shirt, stretching the blue-gray markings above the breast pocket that had probably been words about 600 laundromats ago. He pointed two fingers at Garrett and started to say something, then changed his mind. Garrett was down a little low to be effectively argued with. You felt like you were scolding one of the munchkins. Instead, Cam turned to me and stabbed his fingers lightly into my chest.
You got any idea what Nashville's like?
Do you need those fingers to play guitar? Cam blinked, momentarily derailed. The fingers slipped off my chest. He jerked his head randomly a few times, trying to regain his bearings on the waves, then looked back at me and gave another close-lipped smile. Everything under control again.
She's gonna get one album if she's lucky, son. A week of parties, then adios.
Adios, I repeated. Cam nodded, waved his cigarette to underscore the point.
Old Sheck knew what he was doing, putting her with me. She ditches Cam Compton. She ain't going to last a week.
Oh, I said. Sudden revelation. That Cam Compton. The washed-up artist from Sheckley's stable. Yeah, Milo's told me about you.
I smiled politely and held out my hand to shake. Cam's forehead slowly turned scarlet. He glanced at Garrett, then held up the lid end of his cigarette and examined it.
What'd this son of a bitch just say?
Garrett looked back and forth between us. He pulled his scraggly salt-and-pepper beard the way he does when he's worried.
Can I talk to you? He asked me. Excuse us.
Garrett wheeled himself out of line toward the men's room. I smiled again at Cam, then followed.
Okay, said Garrett when I joined him. Is this gonna be another Texas chili parlor scene?
He gave me his evil look. With the crooked teeth and the long hair and the beard and the crazy stoned eyes, my brother can look disturbingly like a chubby Charles Manson. I tried to sound offended.
Give me some credit. Shit.
Garrett scratched his belly underneath the tie-dyed I'm with stupid T-shirt. He produced a joint, lit it, then started talking with it still in his mouth.
Last time I took you out, we ended up with a $300 bar tab for broken furniture. They won't let me in the chili parlor for Dollar Magnum night anymore, okay?
Well, that was different. I'd burned that guy for workers' comp fraud, and he recognized me, not my fault. Garrett blew smoke.
Cam Compton isn't some out-of-work schmuck, little bro. He's been on Austin City Limits, for Christ's sakes.
You know him well?
He knows half the people in town, man.
Seems like an asshole to me.
Yeah, well, you pass around good shit and give out backstage passes to major shows, you get a little leeway in the personality department, okay? You invited me here, and you're buying the beer. Just don't embarrass me.
He wheeled himself around without waiting for an answer. Cam had disappeared inside the club, probably gone to wax his guitar or tune his surfboard or something. Garrett flashed his blue handicapped placard and made some noise and got us back in the front of the line. then inside. The Cactus Cafe was an unlikely music venue, just a long, narrow room off the corner of the Union Lobby. A stage not much bigger than a king-sized bed, a little bar in back that served beer and wine and organically correct snacks. Not much in the way of atmosphere, but for 15 years, this had been one of the best places in Austin to hear small bands and solo acts. In Austin, that was saying a lot. I followed Garrett through the crowd. He drove over as many feet as he could, getting past the bar into the far wall. I had to stand next to him, pressing against the thick burgundy drapes and hoping the window didn't open and spill us all out into the rain on Guadalupe Avenue. I had enough room only if I used 1 foot and kept my Shiner Bock close to my chest. "Good crowd," I said.
"I caught her last month at Broken Spoke," Garrett said. "You wait."
I didn't have to. Just as Garrett was about to say something else, applause and hoots started up behind us. The band emerged from the back of the room and began pressing through the crowd. First on stage was the pudgy, white-bearded man from the photo on Milo's wall, Willis, Miranda's dad. He looked like a Texas version of Santa Claus, hair and whiskers the color of wet cement, a jolly red face, a well-fed body stuffed into Jordache jeans and a beige collarless shirt. He limped onto the stage with a cane, then substituted a stand-up bass for it. Next came Cam Compton, looking not overjoyed. He stared out at the audience grudgingly, like he was afraid they were all going to pester him for autographs. When he plugged in his Stratocaster, he put a blue pick in his mouth, along with several frizzy strands of his hair. After him came a mousy librarian-looking woman who was apparently Julie Kern's replacement on the fiddle. Then an elderly, rail-thin drummer. That would be Ben French. Then a 40-ish acoustic guitar player with a dark checkered shirt and black jeans and a black Stetson that was slightly too small for his head. Brent, Miranda's older brother. Miranda herself wasn't in the lineup. Daddy Santa Claus leaned on his bass and straightened his straw hat and waved at one of the older couples in the audience. Willis might have been standing on his front porch picking for a few friends or doing an impromptu hoedown at the local Elks Club. The rest of the band looked stiff, nervous, like their families were being held at gunpoint in the back room. After a few minutes of general chord fumbling and string plucking, the musicians all looked expectantly at Miranda's brother Brent. He came up to the mic uncertainly, mumbled howdy, then lowered his head so you couldn't see anything except the brim of his black Stetson. Without warning, he started strumming his guitar like he was afraid it might get away from him. His dad, the bass player, undaunted, looked over at the others.